On the morning of February 1st, 2003, the Columbia Space Shuttle is hurtling through the atmosphere at an altitude of 50 miles above the Pacific Ocean. One of the astronauts has picked up a video camera, and the others in the group are joking and laughing while being filmed. They've been in space for 16 intense days. It's been a successful mission, but now they can't wait to get home to their families, who are waiting on the runway at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. As they fly over the west coast of the United States, they have 23 minutes to land. The shuttle slows down from over 20 times the speed of sound, and the energy creates a powerful fireball. The astronauts look out and enjoy the spectacle. All around the southern United States, space enthusiasts are ready with their telescopes to catch a glimpse of the shuttle and the light phenomenon it creates. But many of those who have seen this kind of thing before think there is something strange about the fire around Columbia, as if it is burning more than usual. As the space shuttle approaches Dallas, Texas, the fire-shaped blob shatters like a firework and falls to the ground. Meanwhile, NASA ground control desperately tries to contact the crew.
This is Mayday, a show about disasters. In this episode, we talk about the Columbia Space Shuttle, one of the biggest disasters in the history of American space exploration. The hosts of this episode are Luke Welland and me, Maya Nalani. Mayday is made by us at the podcast company, Cast. On July 21, 1969, Neil Armstrong becomes the first man to set foot on the moon. In Amarillo, Texas, 12-year-old Rick Husband is watching the landing on TV. He's been fascinated by space and astronauts since he was 4 years old, and if someone asks him what he wants to be when he grows up, he doesn't hesitate for a second. He's going to be an astronaut. There will be a total of 6 lunar landings over 3 years before NASA decides to use their resources for something new. This was the beginning of a new space venture, the Space Shuttle Program, or Space Transportation System, STS, as it is officially called. The space shuttles will be created primarily to transport people and materials to the space stations that are planned to be built. In 1975, construction begins on Columbia, the first space shuttle to be launched. At 121 feet long and 78 feet wide, it looks like a cross between a rocket and an airplane. This is also how it will work. It will launch like a rocket and land like a glider. After 2 years of delays, Columbia is ready to be launched in the spring of 1981. And it's not surprising that it took a couple extra years. The Columbia is the most advanced vessel ever built, and many consider it the most dangerous. The shuttle is so sophisticated that it's almost impossible to calculate all the errors that could occur and what they could lead to.
At 7 o'clock on the morning of April 12, 1981, the time has come. Nearly 500,000 people have traveled from far and wide to watch the historic event and are now waiting with excitement in the stands at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, or at other locations where there's a chance to see the launch. People have not been this interested in space travel since the moon landing 12 years ago. This is the first of what will be a total of 135 space shuttle launches. And magnificent spectacles like the one that audiences witness on April 12, 1981, will continue to impress new groups of spectators for 30 years. Attached to an auxiliary tank and supported by two launchers, Columbia rumbles away in a cloud of fire and smoke. To get into orbit at an altitude of 248 miles and stay there, the shuttle needs to quickly reach a speed of 17,400 miles per hour. For the two astronauts on board, it will be an extremely bumpy ride before the engines shut down and the launchers and extra tank are separated from Columbia. Despite two trips to the moon, Commander John Young has never experienced anything like this before. But everything goes according to plan, and after 2 days and 36 laps around the Earth, they land safely at an airbase in California. Texas boy Rick Husband, who dreamed of becoming an astronaut as a boy, is now 24 years old and has taken the first steps toward his dream job. He has just finished an engineering degree at university and has been accepted as a fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force. This summer, he will learn to fly fighter jets, the natural first step for anyone who wants to fly a space shuttle one day.
Columbia's maiden voyage between April 12th and April 14th, 1981, is considered a success, but it hasn't been entirely free of problems. Already during the journey, the astronauts reported damage on the so-called heat shield on the underside of the shuttle. During deceleration, the enormous kinetic energy of the shuttle is converted into heat, and the temperature on the underside of the shuttle reaches over 1,800 degrees. This is why a heat shield is needed. It consists of around 25,000 small silicone plates to protect the craft during re-entry into the atmosphere for landing. However, the damage was not considered so severe that Columbia could not land safely. It turns out that 148 silicone tiles are damaged, and another 16 are missing completely. It is understood that the heat shield was damaged during the shaky launch. Insulating foam from the auxiliary fuel tank vibrated off and crashed into the shuttle. The astronauts themselves saw the windshield being hit by what they describe as white stuff. In November 1981, Columbia is set to launch again. In the 7 months between the first and second flight, adjustments are made to the launchers in an attempt to reduce the vibrations at takeoff. It works. When Columbia lands at the airbase in California after its second trip, all the heat shield plates are still in place, and only 12 are damaged. NASA continues to keep a close eye on the heat shields. But despite the fact that damage continues to be discovered after each flight, they're content to consider it an acceptable safety risk. After all, the shuttle has landed time and time again without any signs of overheating. In the following years, the space shuttle program was expanded, and Columbia was joined by Challenger, Discovery, and Atlantis. In 1985, 9 launches were made, and in 1986, 14 trips into space were planned. But this was not to be. With the second trip of the year due at the end of January 1986, extra attention is paid to the departure.
Krista McAuliffe, a 37-year-old high school teacher from New Hampshire, has been selected from 11,000 applicants to become the first teacher in space. Her journey will include 2 lessons that will be shown to students across the U.S. On January 28, 1986, the Challenger space shuttle stands ready on the launch pad at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Krista McAuliffe's family are in the stands, and her students are gathered in front of the television in her classroom at home in New Hampshire. The countdown reaches zero, and the Challenger lifts off the ramp. Everything looks normal at first, but after 72 seconds... the space shuttle explodes, about 8 miles above the shocked audience. None of the 7 people on board survive. The event shocks the United States to the core, not least because teacher Krista McAuliffe has become quite a celebrity during the preparations for the flight. The aftermath becomes a nightmare for NASA. It turns out that Challenger was launched in such severe cold that it was not known whether the rockets would work. Several engineers wanted to stop the launch, but NASA had lost patience and pressured them to give the go-ahead anyway. Just as the engineers had worried, the rockets were not able to cope with the cold. During launch, the rockets sit right next to the large fuel tank. An insulating foam is needed to prevent the hot gas produced when the rockets are launched from igniting the explosive tank. The rockets also need to be properly sealed, but in the severe cold of January 28, 1986, the seals did not work properly. As a result, hot gas burned holes in the fuel tank, causing the explosion.
After the accident, all launches were stopped pending the investigation. But 2.5 years later, in the fall of 1988, they're back in operation. A new shuttle, Endeavour, is being built to replace the lost Challenger. Space enthusiast, engineer, and fighter pilot Rick Husband is now 31 years old and works as a test pilot in the development of American fighter aircrafts. He's been married for 6 years and has a young daughter. Deeply religious, Rick lives for his family and his church. But he hasn't given up on his dreams of becoming an astronaut. Quite the contrary. In the following years, he sends applications to NASA on 3 different occasions. The third time, he goes far in the selection process, falling just short of the finish line. But at the end of 1994, after a 4th attempt, he receives the long-awaited news. He is one of 19 astronauts selected from 11,000 applicants. After 5 years of education and training, the time has come. In the spring of 1999, Rick Husband, now 41 years old, participates in NASA's 94th Space Shuttle mission as the pilot of the Discovery. It's also a historic mission for NASA, as it is the first time a space shuttle has docked with the International Space Station, ISS.
After the successful Discovery expedition, astronaut Rick Husband gets his second mission, this time as commander of the shuttle Columbia. In the fall of 2000, a crew of 5 men and 2 women are assembled for the expedition. They're supposed to make their space journey in July 2001. But for various reasons, the expedition is postponed 13 times. The 7 crew members are frustrated by the wait, but decide to make the most of the extra preparation time. For Commander Rick Husband, it is important that they become a cohesive team. From his church work back home in Amarillo, he knows how important this is. Among other things, he takes his 6 new friends rock climbing to build team spirit.
Among the ground staff at Kennedy Space Center, it is said that a space shuttle crew takes on the characteristics of its commander. And the members of the Columbia crew are no exception. Just like their commander, they're serious, friendly, and humble, without the diva tendencies sometimes found in astronauts. This makes them popular with their colleagues at the site. A favorite of many is astronaut and mission specialist 40-year-old Laurel Clark, whose warm personality makes everyone around her feel good. A zoologist by training, she's studying how insects and fish are affected by being in space. This is her first space mission, and her husband, who also works at NASA, is worried. But Laurel doesn't understand his concerns. "If it's dangerous, NASA would have told me," she says. In the end, the launch date is set for January 16, 2003, and 4 days before, an excited astronaut team arrives in Florida. The day before the launch, their families also arrive. 6 of the 7 astronauts are married, with a total of 12 children. The crew is quarantined and not allowed to see their children, but in the evening, astronaut Laurel Clark's husband smuggles their 8-year-old son in to see his mother. They hug for a long time. Laurel knows very well that her son does not want her to go, but the longing for space is just too great. Commander Rick Husband's 2 children, his 15-year-old daughter and 7-year-old son, will have to wait to see their father. but he's recorded little devotional videos for them to watch while he's away.
It's morning, January 16th, and the weather is perfect. At the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, VIP guests, journalists, and other interested parties mingle while the crew prepares in their building. After putting on their orange spacesuits, Commander Rick Husband gathers them in a circle. He wants to say a prayer together, and despite being born in three different countries and belonging to three different world religions, the close-knit group stands in a circle and prays. Then they go out and wave happily to the audience and TV viewers. Smiling, they continue walking the short distance to the car that will take them to the launch pad 46 miles away. This is what they've been waiting for. It's just before 7:30 a.m., and the countdown clock shows T-minus 2 hours and 10 minutes. At 10:39 a.m., the countdown reaches zero, with fire spurting from the stern and a giant cloud of exhaust and water vapor. The Columbia accelerates into the sky. Down on the ground, astronaut Laurel Clark's son is crying profusely, and a few yards away stands a girl who cannot be comforted by her mother's words that her father will return from space in just 16 days.
The day after the crew flies up into space, NASA studies the video of the launch and discovers something worrying. They see the insulation foam from Columbia's auxiliary tank falling onto the shuttle. This is not unusual, per se, but this time the pieces are bigger than before. Many of the engineers are concerned. They're now wondering whether the vital heat shields have survived the severe impacts they've sustained during the launch. Engineers are proposing a satellite take close-up pictures of Columbia to investigate further. NASA officials are hesitant. If the damage is serious enough to endanger the lives of the crew, there is no plan in place to solve the problem. There is no equipment on board to repair such damage. In this case, another space shuttle would have to be launched to dock with Columbia. Then it might be possible to make a repair or evacuate the crew. However, NASA reasons that there is a risk of damage to the heat shields on that shuttle as well. In the end, those responsible decide not to do anything. 15 days into the journey, the day before they're set to land, Commander Rick Husband receives an email about the problem. NASA writes that there is no immediate danger, but that it might be useful for them to know about the incident in case a journalist asks about it when they return. The commander reacts calmly. He asks for the film of the launch, and that evening the crew watches it together. They see large chunks of foam falling off their space shuttle, but none of them seem particularly worried.
The experiments carried out by the crew during their expedition have been successful. Working in two shifts, they have contributed to the understanding of a number of natural phenomena, how living beings are affected in space, and much more. But now, after 16 days in space, on the night between the last of January and February 1st, 2003, it is time for Columbia to begin its landing procedure. Decelerating sharply, the space shuttle is caught by the Earth's gravity. Now everything is on autopilot. The crew is strapped into their seats with their helmets on. Four sit upstairs and three downstairs at the front of the shuttle. The Columbia is due to land at Kennedy Space Center at 16 minutes past 9 a.m. local time. With just over half an hour to go before landing, the Columbia enters the atmosphere at an altitude of 74 miles, somewhere over Hawaii. Popular astronaut Laurel Clark has taken out a video camera and is filming her colleagues on the shuttle's upper deck. They chat and joke for a while, and then move on to watch the amazing spectacle outside. There, the heat from braking has caused flames to crackle around the Columbia's hull. "It looks like a blast furnace," says Rick Husband. "You wouldn't want to be out there," says his pilot, who, like astronaut Laurel Clark, is experiencing this for the first time.
At the command center in Houston, the mood is calm but focused. And at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, spectators are beginning to gather at the end of the runway, which is nearly 3 miles long. The crew's families are escorted by other astronauts, who were there to answer questions about the landing. There are also some journalists present, but they only intend to report a few sentences back to their editors. After all, this is the 112th space shuttle landing, and they have all looked the same so far. It's 7 minutes to 9 when the Columbia enters the United States, just north of San Francisco. In the states of California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas, space enthusiasts are out to catch a glimpse of the shuttle. But when the Columbia appears in the first telescopes, seasoned space shuttle watchers notice that something looks different. Streaks of fire protrude from the shuttle, as if it's leaking, burning debris. Before the Columbia crosses the border into Nevada, ground control in Houston has also received signals that something is not right. Some of the temperature gauges in the space shuttle's left wing show abnormally high numbers, and soon it stops sending signals altogether. However, the shuttle is following its pre-programmed route, and all rudders seem to be working properly. The ground crew becomes more concerned when, shortly afterwards, there are signals of extremely low tire pressure in the Columbia's landing gear. Commander Rick Husband also seems to have noticed the signal and makes a first attempt to call Houston. However, his call does not come through. Columbia, we are seeing low tire pressure signals. We didn't hear your last call, shouts ground control on the radio. Roger that, says Commander Rick Husband, before the communication is cut off again. It's not uncommon for radio signals to fail at this stage of the landing, but as the seconds tick by and Rick Husband doesn't come back on the radio, anxiety begins to spread in Houston. The control room manager makes several attempts to contact the shuttle. Columbia, Houston calling. Columbia, Houston calling.
It's 9 a.m. Florida time. In 16 minutes, spectators in Florida expect to see the Columbia space shuttle land and deploy its large brake parachute. But if you look closely at the large television screens in the stands, you'll notice that the red triangle that until now has shown the shuttle's position on a map has disappeared. The Columbia is now over Texas, and outside Dallas, space enthusiasts are watching the dark silhouette of the shuttle pass by, surrounded by its fiery glow. Suddenly, the fire breaks up into several smaller ones, and like falling comets with their fiery tails, they plummet to the ground. There is no longer a trace of the Columbia silhouette. Spectators on the ground cannot believe their eyes at first, but soon realize what has happened. The Columbia is completely destroyed, and the 7 astronauts in the crew are no more. In the Houston control room, everyone is holding out against hope. But at 12 minutes past 9, the order comes from the control room manager. Lock the doors, no phone calls, no contact with the outside world, he says. There's a tense but calm atmosphere in the control room. While everyone is trying to accept that the space expedition has ended in disaster, they must remain professional. From now on, they are part of an accident investigation. Spectators are still waiting in the stands at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. There are only a few minutes to go before the space shuttle is supposed to land. In the stands, the families of the crew, each accompanied by a designated astronaut, notice how their escorting astronauts suddenly receive text messages. Then the astronauts start pushing the families out of the stands. They say nothing, but the families begin to realize that something serious has happened. The astronaut in charge of popular mission specialist Laurel Clark's husband and son finds the 8-year-old boy standing by a screen. I told her not to go. I told her. The little boy says over and over again.
As many engineers had previously guessed, it turns out that falling insulation foam was the cause of Columbia's failure. For the first time in the shuttle's history, the damage to the heat shield was so severe that the metal in one wing melted, causing the entire shuttle to break apart. The seven astronauts died either from a lack of oxygen when the cabin pressure dropped in the shuttle, from loose objects thrown around in the final seconds before the shuttle broke apart, or from the G-forces generated by the collapse. Part of the recovery effort is, of course, finding the remains of the Columbia and the seven astronauts. A huge search effort involving both NASA staff and volunteers across North Texas and the neighboring state of Louisiana is launched. Eventually, all the dead astronauts and about 40% of the space shuttle are found. The only survivors were some roundworms that mission specialist Laurel Clark had been studying in space, which were found among the debris. By coincidence, the tape from the video camera Laurel used to film the minutes before the disaster is also found. It clearly shows that just minutes before the catastrophe, the astronauts had no idea what was about to happen.
For family members, it's a long road back. Astronaut Rick Husband's wife, Evelyn, works through her grief by writing a book about her husband and his path to his dream job. It is published in the same year as the disaster. 6 years later, she remarries. Popular mission specialist Laurel Clark's husband starts drinking after the accident. But when he realizes that he is becoming an alcoholic, he stops for the sake of his son. Instead, he wholeheartedly participates in the investigation of the underlying causes of the crash. When NASA comes up with a list of almost 30 things they need to change before they can launch a space shuttle again, he feels reassured and can begin to return to life in earnest. After the accident, it was decided that the space shuttle program would be terminated early. But there were 22 more flights between 2005 and 2011 before the three remaining shuttles were parked and put on display in Washington, Los Angeles, and the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. A room on the 16th floor of the Space Center also houses the remains of the Columbia, a reminder of what happened on that morning in February 2003, when the U.S. space program suffered its worst setback ever, with six people losing their partners and 12 children losing a parent.
This has been Mayday, about the Columbia Space Shuttle. The hosts of this episode were Luke Welland and me, Maya Nalani. The script was written by Per Johansson. Sound design by Victor Pearson. Mayday is made by us at the podcast company, Cast.